As many of you listeners know, I've been a reporter here in Las Vegas for a long time, and because I've been around so long, nearly every day I receive letters from prison inmates, and you can tell pretty much as soon as you look at the envelope, the return addresses are a telltale sign. And without opening the letter, it's pretty easy to guess what the contents will be. It's a plea from each of these letters are a plea for help from people who say they've been wrongfully convicted, crimes they did not commit. I always read the letters, and many are interesting, and you'd like to be able to help out and take a look at it, but there isn't much I can do about them. We don't have the resources to reopen investigations or follow up all these leads supplied by the inmates, but and certainly not enough time to look into all of them, given the volume. And you have to wonder if all these people are truly innocent, where are all the guilty people? Without being facetious, it does occur to me that some people do slip through the cracks, that mistakes are sometimes made by our system. Despite the advances in forensic science and DNA, the kinds of techniques that are made popular on TV crime dramas like CSI, those kinds of shows, as I mentioned earlier in the program, have had dramatic effects on how prosecutors present criminal cases. Juries have come to expect DNA evidence, for example, to help wrap things up, to seal the deal. But mistakes are made, and on a massive scale. A famed crime novelist, John Grisham, in the foreword to the book we're about to discuss, says estimates of wrongful convictions range from a low of 2% to as high as 10%. And even if you take the lower number, that means hundreds of thousands of people have been wrongfully convicted. Some of those end up on death row, so it's incredibly serious. Tonight, we take a deep dive into American justice, or the lack thereof, because this could happen to any of us. I think, as we're going to learn from this book, more often than not, it happens to poor people and people of color, but it could happen to you or me as well. And the proof is in this book called The Cadaver King and the Country Dentist. And it sounds like something that John Grisham would write with a touch of William Faulkner, but it's a true story by Radley Balco and Tucker Carrington, and it is a chilling, sobering story that we're going to jump into in just a moment. We'll be right back. Welcome back. The book is called The Cadaver King and the Country Dentist, a true story of injustice in the American South. Now, most of the events we're about to discuss occurred in Mississippi, or at least focused there, but this could happen anywhere. My two guests, the co-authors, are Radley Balco, an investigative journalist and reporter at The Washington Post, who currently writes and edits something called The Watch, which covers civil liberties in the criminal justice system. And Tucker Carrington, the director of the George C. Cochran Innocence Project at the University of Mississippi School of Law, who's worked as a criminal defense lawyer and as a public defender in Washington, D.C. Gentlemen, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having us.
Man, this is a heck of a piece of work you've got here. It's chilling, as I mentioned, because it's focused on these characters in Mississippi, but it could be anywhere. Am I exaggerating?
No, I don't think so, and I think that I appreciate the point because I think Radley and I both do. Because even though it is a sort of Mississippi-based, Mississippi-centric story, the lessons that it has and the story that it tells is applicable across the country.
And Tucker, in your experience as a defense attorney, John Grisham writes the foreword for this book. What's such an amazing coup for you guys to get it? Because I mean, it sounds like something that he would make up, but. He makes the point that there are several reasons why wrongful convictions occur. Have you pretty much gone down that list and experienced all of those in your legal career?
I have.
Can you share some of them with us? I mean, just sort of the laundry list?
Well, I think, in this job, not my public defender job, but in this job, I've had cases of mistaken identification. I've had numerous cases, as it sort of takes up the central portion of the book, of cases that were wrongful convictions based on flawed forensic testimony. And although I haven't dealt with them specifically, close colleagues of mine here have had cases of false confessions, chilling cases, one involving a juvenile, which we touch on in the book. And then another, a triple conviction, one of which was a death penalty conviction from about 30 years ago in Mississippi, which we mentioned very, very briefly. But I've had, just in the decade I've been here, sort of run up against, either directly or indirectly, almost all of the key rationale reasons that John Grisham lists in the foreword to the book.
Radley, why don't you share with us how you were drawn into this particular story? Actually, both of you end up coming at it from different perspectives. Radley, why don't you tell me how you got started down this road, and then Tucker can take the same question.
Sure. Well, I had been covering a story in Mississippi as part of my job, the story of Corey May, who was a guy in South Central Mississippi who shot and killed a police officer during a drug raid. And it turns out the Corey lived on one side of a duplex, and the police were actually after the guy on the other side, and for whatever reason raided both sides of the duplex. And he was home with his daughter. It was 12:30 in the morning when you know, he wakes up to men kicking down his door, and shot and killed one of them, and then one of the officers then immediately surrendered with bullets still left in his gun. And you know, his story was that he was woken up to armed intruders and you know, didn't realize that these were police because he wasn't a drug dealer. And if you wake up to armed men breaking your home in the middle of the night, you tend to think they're, if you're not a drug dealer, at least you probably think they're there to do you some harm. The state claimed that he, you know, he should have known that they were cops, and so they prosecute him for capital murder, which came with the death sentence. And you know, his case really boiled down to whether or not the jury believed him. And one of the expert witnesses for the state was this guy who's kind of one of the central figures in our book, Dr. Stephen Hain, testified that by the trajectory of the bullet, in the body was going down, so therefore Corey must have been sort of laying in wait and trying to ambush the officer, as opposed to what he said, which is he was laying on the floor and shooting up. And the problem is you know, that makes sense until you talk to other medical examiners, and they'll tell you that the trajectory that a bullet takes through a body can change dramatically depending on the position of the body. So if the person who's shot is sort of squatting or jumping or in some, you know, sort of a less than prone position, the trajectory can change when you lay the body sort of prostrate on a table. In fact, there was a bullet hole in the door frame that was going up. So if you have a bullet hole that's in a fixed structure that's going one way, it's going to be a lot more reliable than a bullet going through a body. And as a journalist, I've kind of found over the years that if you find one example of police misconduct or prosecutor misconduct or, you know, some sort of malfeasance on the part of law enforcement, it's probably not the only example. And so I started asking around, and defense attorneys in Mississippi all seem to have stories about this guy. And then I started calling other medical examiners across the South, and it was kind of interesting. No one had written about this guy. I had seen very little sort of the media about him, at least criticism. But when you talk to other medical examiners in the South, I could barely get out. I'm a journalist looking into a controversial medical examiner before they would say, oh, you must be talking about pain in Mississippi. So that really kind of got me interested. And basically for the next 10, 12 years, I just, I worked on a lot of other things, but kept kind of going back to the story and probably wrote, I can't even imagine how many sort of between, you know, formal articles and blog posts I've written. But Tucker, you know, at the same time was sort of litigating a lot of these cases down there, and he can tell you sort of how he got into it. But over the years, we talked many, many times about these cases, and finally kind of realized that this full story needed to be told with all the proper context, and that, given our work over the last decade or so, that we were probably the only two people who could tell it in the way it needed to be told.
And Tucker, you moved to Mississippi to create this Innocence Project at the University of Mississippi Law School, and had some funding from John Grisham and Scott Turow, the novelists. Right?
That's right. John Grisham is a graduate of the Ole Miss Law School, and has been tremendously, he and his family have been tremendously generous to the university for decades now. And I'm sure many of your listeners know Mr. Grisham wrote The Innocent Man in the mid to late 90s, which was his one and only nonfiction book, but it was terrifically well received. And he was has been interested in sort of criminal justice issues since, specifically innocence, wrongful convictions. So I moved down here from D.C. in 2007, and to sort of answer your question about my involvement, really two things happened. One is, and I write about this in the author's note to the book, when I first got here, I didn't have much of an office, in part because I was starting the office. And so the first few days I was getting organized, and I was sort of trying to stay busy and figure out things to do, and we didn't have any cases, of course, yet. So I started reading opinions from the Mississippi Supreme Court, hand-down opinions that had come down that week. And one of the first ones was a case, a murder case from East Central Mississippi that was just like Radley's case, was a ballistics case. It came down to sort of critical ballistics testimony. And I remember reading the case, and I remember reading the majority opinion, which affirmed the conviction, and reading about the expert testimony and thinking to myself, what in the world? How can this be? This is not my experience in the District of Columbia trying cases. How can anybody be qualified as an expert and testify to this? And it turned out to be Dr. Haynes' ballistic testimony. And as Radley said, ends up being one of the main characters in the book. The other thing that happened was early in 2008, the Innocence Project in New York had been working on a case for years. Two lawyers there, Peter Neufeld, who's the co-founder of the Innocence Project, and Vanessa Potkin, who's a longtime staff attorney, have been working on a case in Mississippi for years, long before I got here. And in early 2008, the Innocence Project exonerated Kennedy Brewer, the individual in the case they had been working on for years, and in a companion case, a guy by the name of LaVon Brooks. They had both been convicted in separate cases of child homicides in the same county, prosecuted by the same prosecutor. And the two expert witnesses in both cases were Dr. Hain, who we've been talking about, and Dr. Michael West, who's a bite mark expert. So between my reading of the case and the first couple days I got here, and then several months later, the Innocence Project's work on the Brooks and Brewer cases, I was sort of thrust right into the middle of this 20-year period that we document in the book of sort of forensic science, malfeasance, wrongful convictions.
So you have two murders, two child murders. You have two men who are convicted wrongfully. You have two expert witnesses that were instrumental in both of those convictions. And you keep crossing as you look at cast a wider net, you keep coming up with the same names that pop up in so many cases. You write this book from the with the starting point of you know who committed those crimes, and you know because he confessed to them, or at least pled guilty to them. Radley, why don't you tell us who this guy is, and then we'll work sort of backwards through these two homicides.
Sure. The killer in both of these cases, and keep in mind these murders were in the same town, about just a couple miles apart. And in a county that, rarely sees this kind of murder, they were remarkably similar. Both involved little girls who were abducted from their homes in the middle of the night, sexually assaulted, murdered, and then dumped into a creek. And so in both cases, it was the boyfriend, or in one case, I guess, ex-boyfriend of the mother, who the authorities immediately sort of targeted and seized upon. But in both cases, it was this guy, Justin Albert Johnson, who actually had a history of sexual assault. In fact, as these two cases are going on, he gets caught breaking into two other homes and attempting to sexually assault women. He was a suspect in both cases, but he was, in one case, he was actually cleared by the country dentist from the book's title, this guy Michael West, who was a bite mark analyst and actually cleared Johnson of committing the first crime. And in the second case, he just kind of fell off the radar as a suspect once they honed in on the guy that they thought did it, which was Kennedy Brewer. He ends up confessing almost two decades later after DNA testing in one of the cases proves a match to him. He'd been in and out of jail in the meantime. And he confesses to both crimes. He describes in detail how he did it. He was clearly a mentally ill man. He was diagnosed with schizophrenia after he was arrested. Kind of lived a pretty hard life. He didn't describe sort of seeing his brother die in front of his very eyes as he accidentally, I guess, tipped a pot of boiling water off of a stove onto himself. Clearly a mentally damaged person, but looking back, if the authorities hadn't seized on the wrong suspect in the first case, and if these two forensic experts hadn't sort of been around to do what they did, which was confirm local authorities' sort of suspicions, instead of doing sort of independent, science-based analysis, Johnson's crimes might have stopped after that first one, but unfortunately that wasn't the case.
So these two murders happened in the same little town, same kind of MO to two little girls. They could have caught the guy who did it if they hadn't basically settled on two different suspects based on pretty flimsy evidence in both cases. And they just made up their minds and zeroed in on them and made the facts fit the conviction.
Right. Right. They, I think we make this point in the book, Michael West in particular, who's kind of the more brash and I would say outrageous of the two. I mean, Hain did a lot of damage in his own kind of way, but West was more adventurous and daring with his forensics, I guess you could say, more experimental. But, we make this point in the book for all of his claims, and he claimed to be this sort of forensic wizard who could, find things that nobody else could see or find and make matches that nobody else could match. He never was really able to generate suspects. He was always the guy that local authorities called once they already had a chief suspect in mind, and then he would swoop in and sort of miraculously come up with the evidence that they needed to clinch the conviction. But one of his very earliest ventures was there was a case in Florida, a serial killer in Florida who was attacking college women. And West was called down there to sort of use his forensic wizardry to, scan the crime scenes and find the evidence that, conventional forensic analysts could find. And he came up empty. And the reason he came up empty is because when he went down there, they didn't have a suspect yet. And West was sort of useless if the authorities already didn't have someone in mind. It was only after they had someone in mind that he could make this match. And that's a pretty telltale sign to think that his forensic analysis was really more about just telling police and prosecutors what they wanted to hear.
His qualifications, though, I mean, he was a dentist who sort of built himself into this all-purpose expert who could always be counted on to support the prosecution and the police.
Yeah, he was trained as a clinical dentist, and he sort of came out of the woodwork from Hattiesburg, Mississippi, which is where his practice was, and sort of caught the ways of this particular forensic discipline, which, as Radley said, was sort of really coming to the fore based on these serial killings in Florida. And he wasn't the only one that was practicing in this discipline. There's a governing body for it, for forensic odontologists. That said, he fairly quickly became renowned, was inventing novel techniques that he actually named after himself, and was solving crimes, serious crimes like the LaVon Brooks and Kennedy Brewer cases that we've been talking about.
I'll tell you what, the music is telling us we need to take a break right now. We're talking with Radley Balco and Tucker Carrington about the Cadaver King and the Country Dentist. In a moment, we get into specifics about these terrible crimes and how these suspects were convicted. We'll be right back. This story of the cadaver king and the country dentist, as told in the book by Radley Balco and Tucker Carrington, is horrifying and scary and depressing, because there are so many tragedies packed into these pages, people whose lives were ruined. And when you look at the pattern of how the two central characters, these two doctors, ingratiated themselves with law enforcement, and when you combine race and income and factors like that, and a deck that is stacked against people on the fringes of society, poor people, people of color, and then you realize that it happens all across the country, man, it's scary stuff. In a moment, we're going to tell you how these two guys became so prominent in the Mississippi judicial system, how they sort of earned the trust of police and prosecutors and lined their pockets along the way. And it's a sobering story. We'll be right back. We're talking about the cadaver king and the country dentist. And Radley, I want to ask you to tell us about Dr. Stephen Hayne. That nickname of the cadaver king is well earned.
Yeah, so Dr. Hayne came to Mississippi in the late 80s, and to kind of understand how he was able to dominate the autopsy system there, you got to know a little bit about how autopsies are done there. And so Mississippi is on the coroner system, which is a kind of antiquated system. A lot of people think a coroner and a medical examiner are the same thing, and they're actually two very different positions pretty much all over the country. The coroner is an elected position. In most states, you really only need a high school degree to run for the office. And for a long time, that was the case in Mississippi. Actually, you needed a high school degree and to have never denied the existence of a higher power. It's usually, in most states, the coroner has, the main job of the coroner is they have complete authority over death investigations. So anytime there's a suspicious death, the coroner is in charge of heading up the investigation to figure out if a crime was committed. So in Mississippi, if there was a suspicious death, the coroner would assign the autopsy to a private doctor, usually with consultation from the prosecutor and maybe the sheriff or the local police chief. A lot of cases, the prosecutor has a lot of power and tends to do the assigning, even though the coroner technically is the person that does it under state law. But the way the kind of incentives would work when this was done then is that because they were assigned to a private doctor, and because the coroner and the prosecutor had ultimate authority over who did the autopsy, if you went to a doctor, if you're a prosecutor, let's say, and you went to a doctor with this death, and you said to him, here's what I think happened, and here's what I need you to tell me happened. And they came back the next day and said, well, you know, that's not how it happened. Or more likely, there's just not enough evidence for me to say that that's how it happened. You know, if the prosecutor is sort of, you know, not particularly conscientious or interested in pursuing kind of a pure form of justice, they will, you know, blackball you basically, and you won't be getting any more autopsy referrals. But I think you can even be a somewhat well-intentioned prosecutor and still be kind of, motivated by this kind of misplaced incentive in the system, which is that to say that, you know, maybe the next time you have to refer an autopsy, you consider a doctor, not necessarily because you want one who's going to lie for you, but just because, you know, a doctor who tells you what you think happened is going to seem more trustworthy to you, and so you're going to continue to go back to that doctor. And so basically, by telling prosecutors what they want to hear, in a lot of cases they were right, but in a lot of cases they weren't. Hayne was able to basically sort of monopolize these referrals in the state. So when he started in the late 80s, he was doing, you know, a couple dozen autopsies per year. And by the mid-90s, by the early 90s, he's doing 800, 900, 1,000 per year. And by, the mid-2000s, when, he finally, we're getting sort of toward the end of his career, he was doing 1,500, 1,800, and in some cases over 2,000 autopsies per year. And, you know, just to put those numbers into perspective, I mean, you could do the math yourself and divide, 2,000 by 365, and you're finding he's doing, five autopsies per day, six autopsies per day, assuming he works every day of the year. And, we know just from records that, this was the case. He was doing, at least four, five, six a day. Sometimes he's doing eight or 10 per day. The National Association of Medical Examiners recommends that a doctor do no more than, I believe it's 275 autopsies per year. And if you do more than 325, they won't certify you, regardless of, any other circumstances. So he was doing, five, six times as many as, the maximum recommended by the kind of recognized professional association in the field of forensic pathology. So he was, he was making a lot of money. He was also doing a lot of autopsies in private practice, was getting paid for that. He was getting paid to testify in courts across the state of Mississippi and Louisiana, sometimes in other states. He was doing that, three, four, five times a week, in addition to doing all these autopsies. And on top of all of that, he also held down two full-time positions, one at a local hospital and one at a kidney research facility, or at least he was being paid for a full-time position. There's just, and of course, on top of all that, he was also doing a lot of research papers, that were getting presented at conferences and so forth. He was, presumably doing his continuing education that you're supposed to do as a physician. There just wasn't time enough in the day for him to do all of these things and do them in the way that they should have been done. And so, this is where you find mistakes. This is where you find shortcuts.
I forget where it is in the book, but you listed some of the most egregious examples of mistakes he made. He had claimed or testified that he cut the ovaries out of a decedent, and the guy was a man, not a woman. And he had said something about weighing a spleen, and the person had had the spleen removed years before. Those kinds of things are pretty serious errors.
Right. And, if you look at the practice itself, where these guys did their work, West was usually sort of at Hain's facility helping him with his autopsies for most of his career. But, because Hain had these two full-time jobs during the day, they were doing all these autopsies at night at a mortuary service, a private mortuary service.
Flower shop.
So they were working from 5 or 6 at night till, 2, 3 in the morning. There are stories of people who had visited of them, smoking cigars as they're, working on 2 or 3 bodies at once, sitting out for food and, eating sandwiches while they're doing autopsies. It wasn't the, from what we've been told anyway, it wasn't the most, sort of hygienic, and clean, operation. A lot of people were really disturbed by what they saw, including some former state officials that we interviewed were, just described being sort of disgusted at what they saw when they visited the practice.
So it's amazing how many autopsies this Dr. Hain did while traveling and testifying and had a bunch of other side businesses. And then he brings in Dr. West, whose expertise regarding bite mark science rapidly expands. Tucker, maybe you could tell me the other areas of expertise that he eventually was claimed to have.
Well, there's virtually no limit. He moved on from bite mark matching, which is a sort of pattern analysis, to other pattern analyses. So he would do weapon analyses. He and Dr. Hain worked on a case where they matched a machete-type knife. They said they could see indentations in the hand of the suspect, even though no one else could see it. He became an expert in video enhancement. We actually worked on a case a few years ago where he said he took his computer and did something or other, and then we couldn't quite explain what he had done to enhance a video, which the FBI itself says it couldn't see anything. And Dr. West somehow or another claimed he could see inculpatory actions by the charged defendants. Riley discovered a case of Dr. West out of Ohio where a child had been charged with hurting another child by by pouring bleach on the younger child. And Dr. Webb, the older child, the charged child, said that it had been an accident, that the younger one had gotten into the bleach. Dr. West showed up and said, no, he had done some pore pattern analysis and determined that the pore patterns were indicative of purposeful pouring by the charged child, not accidental. The list just sort of goes on and on, and not only, I should add, not only did the list expand over time, but Dr. West had these sort of homespun probabilistic determinations that he would announce to juries, the most famous one being indeed and without doubt. That was what he testified to in LaVon Brooks's case, for example, that he was indeed and without doubt positive that LaVon Brooks's teeth and no one else's teeth had made the mark on the child. Of course, there's absolutely no valid scientific data that would allow someone to say something like that within that discipline, leaving aside the discipline's sort of larger problems.
Well, in this case, Radley, so a little girl is kidnapped out of her home, is murdered, is dumped in a body of water, and there are some marks on the body. And this Dr. Michael West ends up saying those are bite marks, and he matches it to LaVon Brooks, his teeth, and says there's beyond any doubt he's the guy who did it. There's a real question about, I mean, it doesn't look like they were teeth marks at all, let alone Brooks's teeth.
Yeah, excuse me. I would say at least a half dozen medical examiners have reviewed West's work in these particular two cases since the crimes were committed, and all of them say that these weren't bite marks at all. They were probably insect bites or some other. Both girls, spent some time exposed to the elements. There was a little bit of decomposition in both cases, and so they probably weren't bite marks at all. But the other possibility, I actually have not seen a video of the exam in this particular case, but we do have video of West performing his analysis in other cases, where he actually takes a plaster dental mold of the chief suspect, and he jams it into the skin of the deceased over and over again with enough force that experts we've asked to review these videos say that he's actually creating the bite marks using a plaster molded suspect's teeth that he later uses to implicate these people. And in one of the two cases we write about in the book, that's sort of the main cases in the book, other forensic experts have said that that's what they see in the video there too, that he's actually creating the marks that he later says point to the authority's chief suspect. Now that's a crime. That's manufacturing evidence. That's also desecrating a corpse. And yet, in one of these cases where we have the video, you clearly see him pushing the dental mold in dozens of times over the course of the video. You also see in the video marks appear on the body of the deceased. In this case, it was a 2.5-year-old girl in Louisiana that were not there at the beginning of the video. Despite all that, when I first saw that video, I thought West was going to be arrested. I mean, I thought, it was evidence of him committing a crime. Instead, not only was he not arrested, but that guy's still on death row. But that video didn't even get him a new trial. The system, we talked about this in the book. We've actually talked to, written a little bit about it since the book came out. But the criminal justice system is really bad at correcting its mistakes, or even really acknowledging its mistakes. It usually takes DNA evidence, DNA testing, to get the system to admit that maybe it got the wrong person. And in cases like this one in Louisiana, where West, appears to have created these bite marks, there is no DNA because the question isn't who killed this girl. The question is, was this girl killed at all? The defendant claims that she had a seizure and drowned in the bathtub. The state claimed that this guy, Jimmy Duncan, had raped her and forcibly drowned her, while biting her. And it's main evidence. There's no DNA. There's no, biological material of Duncan's on the girl except for this alleged bite mark that appears that West actually created.
Tucker, you know, as you guys are digging into these cases and hearing stories about the two doctors, there are folks who whisper their reservations about the two. I mean, clearly there were a lot of questions raised about some of these cases along the way, yet law enforcement, police, and prosecutors continued to rely on the two of them and their expertise because they could count on them to bolster their case no matter what the case was. Were there ever any prosecutors who said, you know, we're just not going to use these guys, we don't think they're legitimate, and were willing to say, I'd rather, you know, lose this case than rely on somebody whose expertise is so clearly in question?
There were. And there were some in Mississippi that we spoke with who didn't use either one of them. Well, Dr. Hain was a little bit more difficult because, as Radley talked about earlier, he had cornered the market on autopsy. So if you had a murder case in Mississippi that you needed to prosecute as a prosecutor, sometimes you couldn't. You were hard-pressed to avoid using Dr. Hain. He was the only game in town. That said, there were prosecutors, particularly federal prosecutors, who didn't use him. And there were some people who got a load of Dr. West's nonsense and said, no way, I'm not going down that road. That said, the flip side of the coin is true too, which is there were pockets of in the state where these two were particularly popular, and the Brooks and Brewer cases are sort of cases on point, where there's a particular district and they did a lot of work over the two decades for a particular prosecutor there.
You know, what I was amazed to read in part about the history of coroners and where that all came from, but also about the power of funeral directors in this country and in Mississippi in particular, at least for this era. I mean, that industry had a lot of pull, a lot of say in how some of these cases unfolded. Radley, can you address that?
Yeah, you actually still see that in Mississippi. The system has changed a little bit, you know, since the events of the book for the better, although to this day, I mean, there was just a story in a local paper last week about the state legislature is again underfunding the state medical examiner's office, which is leading to a huge backlog in the crime lab, both with autopsies and just sort of conventional crime lab testing. So, you know, a lot of the debates that we talked about in the book are just happening over and over again. But you do see in the legislature, funeral home directors will run for coroner. They'll use that as sort of a stepping stone. They'll get into the legislature, and they've had a huge effect on sort of crafting the death investigation laws in Mississippi and in other states. And they've really dominated the coroner's office. And I think it's partly just because people think that they just associate death, you know, all the various occupations associated with death are interchangeable. And so, you know, if you're a funeral home director, of course you're going to make a good coroner. That just, you know, goes hand in hand. But also, you know, the coroner tends to be a very low-paying position. People use it, again, as a stepping stone into politics. But for funeral directors, it actually can be a pretty lucrative position because if you're the coroner, you are the first person on the scene for every suspicious death, which means when it then comes time for the family to pick, you know, a funeral home for funeral services and for embalming, you have had first crack at them. And so a lot of funeral home directors, funeral home owners would run for the position because it was a good way to, you know, drum up business. And so they came to kind of dominate the position. And, you know, if they weren't running for it, they were spending money to make sure the right person got the job. I when I started the book, I'd done enough reporting in this area to, you know, that I knew that a coroner was an elected position, that it, you know, coroner and medical examiner were not the same thing. But the history of coroners was something I learned as we were researching and reporting the book. And it's,
well, we'll get into that in the next segment here. Haynes and West made a lot of money, and they spread a lot of money around, and the result was devastating for Brewer and Brooks. We'll get into that part of the story in a moment, talking about the Cadaver King and the Country Dentist here on Coast to Coast AM.